Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
The Russians wanted to make future NATO and enlargement rounds as painful as a root canal treatment, so that NATO would not go to that particular dentist in the future again.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, a counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. My normal partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, is traveling, but he'll be back next week. But in the meantime, I'm very glad to welcome to Shield of the Republic our special guest this week, Stefan Keininger, who is a fellow at the American German Institute and was a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center before the current administration in Washington decided to dispense with it. It was doged to death, unfortunately, but an important center for, particularly for the study of Cold War history and of the post-Cold War. Stefan is also the author of Securing Peace in Europe, Strobe Talbot, NATO, Russia, and the Search for Peace after the Cold War. It will be published next week by Columbia University Press. It is a terrific read, and I say that advisedly because it's a little odd, Stefan, to read a book that is meant to be a history in which you find yourself as a very bit player. And I want to stress that I was a very bit player in all of this. But welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Thank you, Eric, so much for having me on. It's a great pleasure, and I'm so glad you spoke with me for the book. On Strobe, you worked with Strobe back in the 1990s, so it's a real pleasure for me to be here and to chat with you.
Yeah, I don't have many claims to fame, but the one unique quality I have is I'm the only person who ever worked twice for Strobe Talbot and twice for Dick Cheney. So, it tells you something. Tell me, Stefan, and maybe just for our viewers and listeners, what brought you to this subject? What made you take up this subject? And maybe talk a little bit about Strobe himself and the role he played in the 1990s. He was a relatively well-known figure, if not a cabinet official, but certainly probably the most prominent sub-cabinet official in the Clinton administration. But I think, contemporary listeners may not really be able to place him in all this. So if you could just kind of talk a little bit about what brought you to the subject and about Strobe as a subject.
That's a great question. Several things actually brought me to the subjects. One key factor is the declassification of archival sources. Strobe's State Department papers have been declassified starting in 2019 based on a Freedom of Information Act request from the National Security Archive. So if you go online to the State Department's Freedom of Information Act website and you type in Talbot in the search function, you have about 4,000 entries currently, and the collection is still growing. So that was one key factor for me. Another key factor is that I could use his diaries. I spoke with him 3.5 years ago, and he was so kind and shared his meticulous diaries with me. He kept really a very detailed diary throughout the 1990s when he was in government. It's about 5,000 pages. Now that's just the 1990s. I could draw on that, and then there's my curiosity also. I was trained as a Cold War historian, wrote two books on the late Cold War, on the Helsinki Final Act, and on the 1980s. And then I was on the search, for a new subject. And I met Strobe for the first time in April 2019, when I was a fellow at the Johns Hopkins SCIES, when we had an oral history workshop with contemporary witnesses, and when I was working with Dan Hamilton and Christina Spohr, and that's when I met Strobe for the first time, and that triggered my interest in the history of NATO enlargement. And why did I chose Strobe? Because he sort of underappreciated, I think. He was such a tremendously important figure in the 1990s. His portfolio was enormous. He was in charge of Russia NATO enlargement, the NATO Russia Founding Act. He negotiated on Kosovo, on Bosnia, also on India and Pakistan, and that is not even part of the book. Negotiated on Haiti. So he was tremendously important throughout both administrations, and so his diplomacy is a through line in the book, and I use his perspective for my analysis. He brought a lot of experience. He knew all the places. He had been a journalist. He was stationed in Yugoslavia in the early 1970s. He knew Kosovo, he knew Bosnia, he knew the languages, he speaks perfect Russian. He translated and edited Nikita Khrushchev's memoirs when he was in his mid-20s, that was in the late 1960s, when he was a housemate of Bill Clinton at Oxford. That's how the two of them met and got to know each other. And of course, he had Clinton's trust, was one of his most trusted advisors throughout both administrations. And that sort of gave him a unique perspective and a unique vantage point.
You do a lovely job, actually, of outlining all that, his, special relationship with the president, with Bill Clinton, because Strobe was, as you point out, he was a pretty distinguished journalist, a Time magazine's diplomatic correspondent. He'd written several, before he came into government, several histories of arms control, including one, Deadly Gambits, about Richard Perle and Richard Burt in the early 1980s in the Reagan administration, that became a New York Times bestseller, quite well-known book, which even featured actually in the Reagan-Mondale debate of 1984. So he certainly was extremely knowledgeable. As you point out, he had translated Khrushchev's memoirs. And his role was initially meant to be limited to the former Soviet Union. And I should... full disclosure for our listeners, I mentioned I worked for him twice. I helped him set up that office in the spring of 1993 for 4 months before I went off to be the deputy chief of mission at our embassy in Prague in the Czech Republic, which had just gone through the Velvet Divorce. He then, after the pretty rocky first year of the Clinton administration and foreign policy, was moved up to become the Deputy Secretary of State to Warren Christopher. But he kept really the Russia portfolio for the most part. There was a period when he sort of gave it up, but as you point out, in one of the rough patches in U.S.-Russian diplomacy, he came back in and reassumed that portfolio. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about his role in helping kind of establish what became to be known as the sort of Bill and Boris show, the relationship between Bill Clinton and Boris Yeltsin that became quite close. I mean, there's an irony, I would say, here, because one of the lines of criticism of the George H.W. Bush administration in the period at the very end of the Cold War, with the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and then ultimately collapse of the Soviet Union in December 1991, was that President Bush, 41, had invested too much in his personal relationship with Gorbachev, and that as a result, he and some of his advisors may have been insufficiently attentive to some of the fissiparous forces inside the Soviet Union that were driving it apart, and kind of led him to hang on to Gorbachev long past his sell-by date, when it was clear that the Soviet Union was in a state of decay and kind of collapse. So the fact that, you know, Clinton and Yeltsin ended up having this famously pretty close relationship for 8 years, you know, not necessarily, you know, completely intuitive.
Right. So the Bill and Boris relationship was basically the essential flywheel in the U.S.-Russia relationship. Clinton and Yeltsin met 18 times in 8 years. That's more than all of the U.S.-Soviet summits during the Cold War taken together. And nowadays, when we look back, we take this Bill and Boris relationship for granted. But we should not take it for granted. And I point that out in the first chapter of my book, because the convocation of their first meeting in Vancouver in April 1993 was really contested. There was a competition within the Clinton administration about this summit, whether it was wise to convene it at such an early point in time or not. And Clinton's gut feeling was that he should have such an early summit to really help the reform process in Russia at a difficult point in time, when the entire reform project in Russia was in crisis and when Yeltsin was desperate for a meeting. And the Secretary of State Warren Christopher and National Security Advisor Tony Lake were not enthusiastic about this idea. They were rather cautious, and the conventional wisdom was to be more careful, actually, and to wait. But Clinton did not want to wait, and Talbot supported Clinton's view and argued in favor of an early meeting as a way to engage Yeltsin, as a way to back him up when he was attacked from the communists, when it was not really clear whether he would be in office, like when the summit actually took place. It was kind of a bet at the time, and so that was Clinton's instinct, and Talbot supported him in that view. And there's a lot of stuff in Talbot's diaries about these internal discussions in March 1993, and so this was really a key moment early on in the presidency, and this gave Stroke Talbot a boost also in internal debates, because he and Clinton had a similar view and were determined to be supportive and to help out Yeltsin. And from then on, it was really the essential channel. And they had a second meeting at the World Economic Summit in Tokyo in July 1993, when Clinton succeeded in convincing Yeltsin to stop Russian missile support for India, and that was a very big deal at the time. And that sort of was a vindication for the view that it was right to engage Yeltsin. And then, of course, came the trilateral negotiations on Ukraine's denuclearization. That was the next huge issue on which Clinton engaged Yeltsin. So these were really, really essential issues at a very early point in time, and also Russia's constitutional crisis in the autumn of 93. So it was a year full of crisis, but also full of opportunities. And it was essential to have this this close connection. And Talbot himself, of course, had this so-called strategic stability group with his Russian counterpart, Georgi Nemyedov. And there was, of course, the Gore-Chernomyrdin Commission. So there were several high-level channels to keep this going.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I particularly like about the book is I think it redresses the balance a bit in people's appreciation here, because Strobe's book that he wrote after his time in government, The Russia Hand, has a the conceit of the book is that that although everybody perceived Strobe as the Russia Hand, and in fact he became quite a lightning rod for criticism by Republicans, which probably kept him from being considered for Secretary of State in the second term, or even National Security Advisor, although he came very close to becoming National Security Advisor in the second term. But in the book, he suggests that it's actually Bill Clinton who was the Russia hand, which is a part of the truth, because as you just suggested, the Clinton-Yeltsin channel was absolutely crucial for managing a whole series of crises, and we'll get to some of them in a minute, like Bosnia, like Kosovo, other issues that kind of roiled the prospects for a Europe whole and free, a post-Cold War divided Europe. But your book, I think, redresses the balance, because while it's true that Clinton and Yeltsin had this essential relationship, Strobe did a lot of the stage management of all of this, and helped set the stage through his channel with Mamedov, which was in some ways a continuation of a diplomatic channel that had been created under the Bush 41 administration between Dennis Ross and Mamedov. And so that in some sense was a line of continuity that seems quaint today when you think back on it. But was crucially important, as you suggest. It was important in particular as they got into the issue of Ukraine. I was there for the beginning of all that. My successor, Steve Pfeiffer, stayed through to the negotiation of the Budapest Memorandum. This is a much misunderstood period, and I think actually even Bill Clinton to some degree has contributed a bit to some of the misunderstanding of this with some of his comments in recent years. There are a couple of realities that don't get discussed about this, which you do touch on. And one which you didn't actually touch on, but I think was very important, which is that this took place in the context of an upcoming review conference of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and the making of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty a permanent agreement as opposed to one that had to be renewed every 5 years. And so the prospect of a new nuclear nation emerging out of the wreckage of the Soviet Union could have been fatal to the extension of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. That was the biggest, broadest context. But as you point out, these weapons were actually, they were weapons left on the soil of Ukraine, but never really in Ukraine's control. They were controlled by the Russian army and the strategic rocket forces, actually. And that Ukraine lacked the infrastructure and the financial means to actually maintain and continue to have an independent nuclear deterrent. And many of the weapons, which were actually long-range ballistic missiles, weren't even particularly well suited to the task of deterring Russia. And so the prospect that we faced in 1993 was a messy fight over the control of these weapons, which could have had truly disastrous consequences, and finding some way to compensate Ukraine and to provide Ukraine with some assurances, not the legal guaranteed security assurances that they wanted. They wanted something like an Article 5 guarantee, but nonetheless, an agreement which Russia willingly signed and which is now violated, recognizing the borders of Ukraine as they existed in 1994 when the Budapest Memorandum was signed. Can you talk a little bit about Strobe's role in all that and how that all came about?
He went to Kiev in May 1993 for an important visit and discussions with Ukraine's president, Leonid Kravchuk at the time. And he tried to broaden the agenda in U.S.-Ukrainian relations because the non-proliferation and the nuclear issue was a dominating one, and the Ukrainians were hesitant to abandon these nuclear weapons they inherited because they were afraid of Russia, of Russian revisionism, for good reasons, as we now know. And Strobe tried to broaden the agenda and give them an economic perspective and provide them with funds from the Nunn-Lugar program in return for the denuclearization of Ukraine. And then he had crucial meetings in July 1993, especially with Ukraine's deputy foreign minister Boris Tarasyuk, who approached Strobe with strong demands for NATO Article 5 guarantees. That was new to me. I found that in Strobe's diaries. So Tarasyuk was really outspoken about the need for NATO Article 5 guarantees. That was something that was new to me. And so they really had an argument about these security guarantees. And there was at that time no opportunity to provide these guarantees to the Ukrainians, because that would have opened the Pandora's box, because Belarus and Kazakhstan would also have demanded these kinds of guarantees. So it was out of the question at the time. And that almost brought the whole process to a collapse. Because NATO did not have a policy actually on enlargement in the summer of 1993, that only emerged later on in the autumn of 93 and later on in 94. It was a bundle of pre-existing security guarantees of language from other international treaties, from the from the Helsinki Final Act, and so a combination of principles that was too weak because there was no enforcement mechanism in the Budapest Memorandum and no penalties for a violation of the Budapest Memorandum. But there was perhaps no better solution at the time. When you think back in 93, there was no blueprint and no, 30 years later, it's somehow tough to admit this, but, at the time, the issue was so complex and so conflict ridden. Everyone was searching for a feasible solution. And there was a search for a solution, which then became the Trilateral Agreement of January 94, and then the Budapest Memorandum of December 94. And the Ukrainians, as you pointed out, they did not have operational control of these weapons. So in order to be, if they had kept them, they would have stayed dependent on the Russians. So in order to be really independent, they had to abandon them. That's a contradiction, but that Boris Tarasyuk himself, I spoke with him. He said, okay, that was finally they decided, okay, we have to abandon these weapons. There is no other way, because the opportunity costs would also have been tremendous if they had decided to keep the weapons. They would have burnt the bridges, in relations with the Americans and with NATO.
It's worth, I think, also recalling that for 20 years, Russian leaders did not call any of this into question, including Vladimir Putin, who signed other agreements validating the border of Ukraine, as it existed in 1993. I think it was 2002 or 2003 he signed a treaty between the two of them. So this was not even, it was really Putin who, you know, brought this into question. It was not really a question before. I want to come back to that because your book is a very, you know, good antidote to anybody who has wasted the brain cells to read either the proposed treaties that Lavrov gave to Tony Blinken in December of 2021 or Vladimir Vladimirovich's 6,000-word essay on the unity of the Ukrainian and Russian people. There were other unresolved issues that bedeviled European security and NATO at the time as well, which you you cover also. And Strobe, although he was not a, you know, a kind of direct participant in this, does play a role here in recruiting Richard Holbrooke to come back from Germany to become Assistant Secretary for Europe and becoming really a I wouldn't say patron, but a sort of a cheerleader inside the Clinton administration for Holbrooke.
Yeah. The Bosnian War was a tremendous problem, undermining the post-Cold War security system in Europe, because it was threatened to undermine the principles on it was on which it was based: sovereignty, the rule of law, human rights, and the Bosnian War was just undermining everything that the Clinton administration tried to build up. And Strobe was, I would say, quite hawkish on Bosnia. In April 1993, President Clinton called him to ask for advice on Bosnia. And Strobe, argued in favor of bombing the Bosnian Serbs. Actually, do a NATO bombing campaign, 2 years before it finally took place in 1995. And he was quite hawkish. He had also been criticizing the Bush administration when he was still a journalist with Time magazine in 91 and 92. And then he recruited Richard Holbrooke, who used to be the ambassador to Bonn, to bring him in to work on Bosnia and on NATO enlargement and to pursue a more vigorous approach. And this was all contested at the time. And there was, a long debate about the best way to resolve Bosnia and about NATO's role. And Senator Richard Lugar brought this up in August of 1993 when he argued not just for an enlargement of NATO's membership, but also for an enlargement of NATO's mission. When he argued that NATO had to go out of area or it would go out of mission, go out of business. And that was an observation that Strobe shared. And he pushed Clinton time and again to assume a more muscular approach in Bosnia. And I have a nice quote here actually from Strobe's diaries. That's from April 1994, when Strobe says to Clinton, quote unquote, "Undivided Europe, that's your vision. There's no hope for it if we have Rwanda 10 times in the middle of Europe. Since January, you've had a concept that drives the policy. Can the Bosnian Serbs be allowed to defy and defeat the greatest power on earth, the US, NATO, the Alliance? Run out of Gorazde on a rail, it can't happen." And that was Strobe's position. So he and later on after the conclusion of the Dayton Peace Agreement in 1995, Strobe was also among the ones who pushed for the inclusion of the Russians actually in a joint peacekeeping mission in Bosnia. He helped to turn Bosnia from a problem into an opportunity to really get the Russians to join NATO's peacekeeping force, and that was quite an achievement. I mean, Clinton and Yeltsin discussed it at their Hyde Park meeting in New York in October 95 and also during the G7 Halifax meeting in June 95. And Strobe had several missions and visits to Moscow when he discussed all of this with the Russian foreign minister, Andrei Kozyrev, and with Mamedov, searching for opportunities to have a joint peacekeeping mission, something that is also often forgotten nowadays. That was a huge accomplishment at the time, actually.
Yeah, I mean, Strobe's role is interesting here because, again, because I think it's underappreciated. In the first instance, I think he was pretty instrumental in convincing Clinton and Sandy Berger and others that it was worth bringing Holbrook back from Germany to take on the job of Assistant Secretary for Europe. Holbrook was a big personality, very ambitious, captured nicely in the recent biography of him by George Packer. But he also, you know, had a pretty strong sense of his own self. And he had been an assistant secretary in the Carter administration. And so being an assistant secretary again, even Europe and even with Bosnia going on, you know, took a little bit of convincing by Strobe to get Holbrook to do it. Turned out to be, I think, a brilliant stroke for everybody, including Clinton, in the sense that Holbrook was relentless in the pursuit of an objective and, you know, ultimately succeeded in bringing the Bosnian War to an end at Dayton. You know, he's written his own memoir of that to end a war, which goes into great detail about that, but it really was a really quite an achievement. Again, I think people look back on it and don't recognize it for the achievement it was, because before Ukraine, the Bosnian War was the largest war in Europe since World War II, created enormous problems with refugees. And I think the thing that Strobe and I shared as a concern was the potential for it to spill over outside of Bosnia to Macedonia and from Macedonia to, among other places, Bulgaria and then potentially Turkey. And so it could have become a concatenation of disasters that could have really been terrible for the security of Europe. I mean, obviously, there have been a whole series of wars there in that part of the world leading up to 1914. So not something that I think anybody, you know, wanted to gainsay as a prospect. That in some sense set the table for, you know, the NATO enlargement process, which, you know, again, I think is underappreciated as an achievement because there were a lot of moving pieces to it. And although in one sense, Russia was weak, there was nothing really Russia could do about NATO enlargement. It couldn't stop it. Although, as your book shows in detail, there were multiple efforts made by Yeltsin and especially by Yevgeny Primakov, who succeeded Kozyrev as foreign minister, to try and stop it. But in the end, what happened was a process in which NATO enlarged step by step in a way that didn't disrupt the Russian presidential election of 1996. Yeltsin was able to get reelected. There's a whole nother story there about how that happened. But to keep the reform process alive in Russia, there was a negotiation of a NATO-Russia founding act that created a permanent joint council. But there were other pieces as well. There was a NATO-Ukraine piece. There was a Baltic action plan to keep the Balts and the Swedes and Finns kind of engaged while this process was going on that paid benefits way down the road, I would say, as a former U.S. ambassador to Finland and someone who was very pleased to see Finland join NATO 2 years ago. And there was a Black Sea dimension to it to keep Turkey oriented towards Europe and keeping its candidacy for EU membership alive. I got to play a little bit of a role in that when I was ambassador to Finland, and Turkey's candidacy came back on the agenda of the EU. And then I got to be a U.S. ambassador to Turkey when in Brussels in 2004, the Turks actually took yes for an answer, which was a whole, that'd be a whole nother story. But talk a little bit about Strobe's role in all of that, in the making of NATO enlargement.
You mentioned all the pieces of the puzzle, and Strobe played a tremendous role in putting these parts of the mosaic, putting these pieces together. Because nowadays, when we talk about NATO enlargement, the debate is just often about NATO and Russia. But actually, it was much broader, as you have mentioned it. And it was much broader in the sense that Strobe had all of these pieces of the puzzle on his mind, and he worked permanently on them, because he had, you guys had to take care of the Baltics, of Turkey, and of course you also had to take care of the states that did not make the first NATO enlargement round, such as Bulgaria. Then there was a debate about Romania. There was Slovenia. Then you had the whole Baltic dimension, because initially most people were hesitant to even discuss Baltic NATO membership in the early and mid 1990s. These were all important initiatives. Then there was an increasing role for the OSCE, the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe. Then you had the enlargement of the European Union. Then you had Turkey's rapprochement with the European Union, which you guys endorsed and which Strobe pushed in a number of public statements, also in Germany, for instance, in a speech in 1998 in Berlin. The Kohl government did not like it at the time, and Richard Holbrooke coined an interesting metaphor on these efforts. He said, "The thing is, expanding the Europe of the institutions to the Europe of the map. So integrating all of Europe's so-called periphery, and opening up the institutions of the West, not just NATO, but also the European Union, then creating regional security arrangements like the Council of the Baltic Seas, like the Baltic Action Plan. Then later on, after the Kosovo War, the Southern European Stability Pact, and so on and so forth. So it's not just NATO enlargement. It's a variety of initiatives to really work for a Europe whole and free, based on the principles of openness and integration and interdependence. And that was actually the broader blueprint of the Clinton administration's diplomacy, and Strobe played a key role in all of these initiatives at the time, and it was always a Russia friendly enlargement of NATO, because engagement with Russia always preceded steps of opening up NATO, and NATO did not deploy nuclear weapons in the new member states. It did not deploy permanent combat forces there. These were all tremendous concessions which were enshrined in the NATO-Russia Founding Act. Again, this is all important to today when we hear the story of the Russian grievance narrative that Russia was misled and mistreated and humiliated. That's all nonsense. It doesn't make sense, really. The Clinton administration really exhausted all opportunities to work with Russia, and that's pretty clear. And that was one key dimension of Strobe's diplomacy at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, it seems a little quaint in an era of, you know, rising national populism, you know, both here and in Europe. But, you know, the power of collective security organizations was really kind of on display, and not just NATO, but also obviously also the EU. I mean, I think we started from the premise that, first of all, NATO had to move first, because you really couldn't get the kind of, you know, integration with the EU and the, first of all, to meet all the chapters of the acquis communautaire to join the EU is a lengthy process. And that it, in any event, if you think back to the early post-war, during the Cold War, it was the establishment of security with the Brussels Pact and then NATO that laid the groundwork for the emergence of the European community and then ultimately the EU in the first place. And so that we had to take care of the security vacuum that was emerging in the first instance. As you know, as a historian very well, Stefan, I think it was... the Brits who coined the phrase that NATO exists to keep the Americans in, the Russians out, and the Germans down. My view was we were engaged in keeping the Americans in and bringing other Europeans in, including potentially Russia. I mean, the door was always kept open. As you point out, there were no surprises. There was never a point where we pulled anything, any rabbit out of the hat. There was an episode where there was a little bit of a crosstalk, which was between Yeltsin and Clinton over the Partnership for Peace, which I think Americans all saw as a kind of a slow-moving way station. By the way, You cite a memo I wrote for Strobe in 1993, which sketched out precisely this, that this was going to be a process that would take about a decade. And when I look back at that memo recently, I realized that the timeline turned out to be almost not quite exact, but pretty close to what you know came after. And the point was, to me anyway, that NATO has always been a collective defense organization. That's its primary purpose and mission. And we didn't want to do anything to detract from that or get in the way of it, because it's been the most successful military alliance, I would argue, in the history of the world. But it also always had another dimension. It also always was, at the same time it was a collective defense arrangement, a collective security arrangement, which helped manage, first and foremost, the reintegration of the FRG into Europe and overcoming, you know, more than a century of Franco-German antagonism. The idea of the Franco-German motor of Europe wouldn't have been possible without NATO. It also was a mechanism for managing the ongoing and continuing to this day tensions between Turkey and Greece, and so it always had this collective security role. And I think the notion we had was that as NATO enlarged, it would bring more and more security to the countries who became members, but also ultimately to their neighbors, because those countries were not going to attack their neighbors, because NATO is a defensive alliance by its nature. And that extended ultimately to Russia as well, and would. I think the great tragedy, and I don't know if you agree with this or not, I think the great tragedy of all of this is we created a mechanism with the Founding Act of the Permanent Joint Council, which gave the Russians, had they chosen to use it, a mechanism for really constructively engaging with NATO and with the rest of Europe. And they chose to turn their back on it. They chose not to use it. That was a choice, a calculated one, I would say.
It was a calculated choice also to use the NATO-Russia Founding Act as a way to undermine NATO and to get a to really get a say in NATO's internal decision-making processes, and actually to gain a veto in NATO's internal decision-making, and also to make future rounds of NATO more painful. You wrote an interesting memo, and Strope writes about it in his diary when you said the Russians wanted to make future NATO enlargement rounds as painful as a root canal treatment, so that NATO would not go to that particular dentist in the future again. And that was quite accurate because the Russians did not see the potential of this NATO-Russia permanent council, and they were always talking about equality, but when they meant equality, they actually meant that NATO should consult them first before taking internal decisions, and that was a huge misunderstanding and a misconception, so there was a lost opportunity, I think, because the NATO-Russia Founding Act was a provided enough flesh and enough substance basically for permanent consultations, and the Russians just had also problems to really understand the inner workings of NATO and the European Union as institutions. They always had a preference to deal with the big powers and to make bilateral deals. They had a hard time to deal with NATO and the European Union, and that became quite obvious in 97 when the Russian interlocutors were hesitant to have a real discussion with NATO Secretary Javier Solana, the official part of the negotiations. Of course, the Clinton administration did a lot of the heavy lifting, but Primakov was really, really hesitant to have a meaningful dialogue with Solana, and time and again complained about his positions, about his role. So there was always there this kind of reluctance, and also I think the Russian side did not have a clear idea what the European security system would look like in 10 or 15 years from the early or mid 80s, what it would and 90s, what it would look like in the 2000s or 2010 with an enlarged European Union and enlarged NATO, and what kind of a role could they play, how could they integrate, how would they fit in. And all of that was to their benefit, as you said, an enlarged zone of peace and not just collective defense, but also collective security. Nobody would attack them. They had peaceful and stable neighbors, the Baltics, the Poles. So all of this was in their interest, basically. Should have been in their interest.
And as you and I think we're talking in the green room before we started this podcast, when the Russians invaded Ukraine in 2014, there was not a single U.S. tank in Europe. I mean, the idea that there was some kind of military threat here from NATO to Russia was really laughable. You devote a lot of attention appropriately to the Asian economic crisis and the role it played in precipitating a economic crisis in Russia. I mean, that's another episode, I think, that demonstrates, you know, the falsity of this narrative about how the West abused Russia or took advantage of it during its period of weakness. On the contrary, the Clinton administration, you know, despite some of the better judgments of Secretary Rubin, the Secretary of Treasury, whatnot, basically did everything it possibly could to support the ruble and to support Yeltsin and his government throughout that crisis, and support Russia throughout that crisis.
Absolutely, absolutely. Clinton administration did all it could to back up Yeltsin, to support Russia. Strobe went to Russia in the midst of the economic meltdown in August 1998 to have discussions with the Russian leadership. He called it a scouting expedition, which was quite, risky and adventurous at the time, because he wanted to elaborate on the chances for another Clinton visit in Moscow, which was kind of uncertain, but finally Strobe advocated in favor of Clinton's going to Moscow in times of crisis. So Clinton went finally in September 1998, when had the summit with a weakened Yeltsin, and he did not want to let Yeltsin down in times of crisis, and that was an important signal at the time. And so this is just another example of the Clinton administration supporting Russia in times of crisis and turmoil. And and this was then also later important during the Kosovo War, of course, in 1999, when the Clinton administration sought for ways to integrate Russia and make Russia part of the solution and not just part of the problem. And and that was also one of Strobe's key achievements as a negotiator, that he was able to talk to the Russians and to have Chernomyrdin as an interlocutor, and to have this trilateral format with Chernomyrdin and Ahtisaari, to find a negotiated end to the war in Kosovo.
Yes, and it was his relationship with Martti Ahtisaari that, was very crucial here. His brother-in-law, Derek Scheer, had been ambassador to Finland, so he knew Ahtisaari well, having been there a couple of times. And then, of course, I ended up succeeding Derek and worked very closely with Ahtisaari while he was involved in all of this negotiation with Strobe and Chernomyrdin that ultimately got Milosevic to withdraw his troops from Kosovo. But it also led to a kind of blow up and crisis with the Russians. And it really, in some sense, was the first sort of major interaction that a lot of Americans, including Strobe, had with Vladimir Putin. You might want to talk about that a little bit, because it was an interesting introduction to the future president of Russia.
Yeah, Strobe first met Putin on the 11th of June in 1999 in Moscow, when Putin was not even prime minister. He was still the secretary of the National Security Council and FSB director. And when Strobe heard rumors that the Russians were planning to invade Kosovo unilaterally, moving their troops from the peacekeeping troops from Bosnia and Herzegovina to Kosovo. And Putin denied that and played it down. But a day later, or that night, the Russian troops really went from Bosnia and Herzegovina to Kosovo, invading Kosovo unilaterally. And Strobe had his plane turn around and confronted Putin the next day. And he again played it down, and this really stuck with Strobe, that Putin was not to be trusted, not at all. That Putin was still who he used to be, namely a KGB a guy and a paranoid a counterintelligence officer, who could not be. Could not be trusted, basically, and that loomed really, really large. And Strobe, then in December 1999, during the second war in Chechnya, confronted Putin again about this first lie of the summer of 1999, And he was really, he really identified the potentially dangerous sides of Putin very early on. And his advice, Strobe's advice for Clinton was to keep a distance and to deny Putin the kind of warm relationship that Clinton used to have with Yeltsin. That was Strobe's basic piece of advice for Clinton. So, and Strobe also speaks about it in a in the PBS Frontline interview, The Putin Files. He talks about it in great detail. And there's another quite interesting episode dating back to April 1996, when Putin, then as deputy mayor in St. Petersburg, managed to manipulate Clinton's visit to St. Petersburg when Putin managed to keep Clinton away from the people of St. Petersburg, when they had a lunch in a dungeon-like restaurant with no windows at all, and when a lot of the people of St. Petersburg gave Clinton the finger because he was just sitting in his limousine and rushing through the streets, and that was also Putin's work at the time, as Jim Collins found out in 96.
So yeah, I think both Strobe and President Clinton shared a certain skepticism about Putin in the last year of the Clinton presidency, when Putin had ascended and become first acting president, and then in March of 2000 was elected. And his statements, I remember at the time from my perch in Helsinki, discussing this with some of the really good Finnish experts on Russia, and they and I were all very chilled by Putin's invocation of the need for the dictatorship of law, as he put it. You know, dictatorship coming out of the word, you know, however, you know, modified by, you know, other words in the same sentence, coming out of the lips of a Russian leader is always a little bit chilling for anyone who knows the history or who had lived there during the Soviet period. So yeah, I think Strobe was really quite prescient in foreseeing some of the things that that we have seen emerge out of Russia over the time that Putin has been president, carrying it in a more and more authoritarian, now I would say pretty much totalitarian direction. Stefan, I want to thank you. We've really run out of time, but I want to thank you for writing this book. I think it's a overdue, you know, corrective. It deals, as several other scholarly works have done, I think, definitively with the notion that there was some kind of broken promise about NATO not moving, you know, forward one inch from the time of German reunification. Is very clear from having read those memcons myself at Strobe's direction when we were doing NATO enlargement, that Secretary Baker and President Bush and all those conversations with Gorbachev and Shevardnadze were discussing the Eastern lender of Germany, not other countries, which they couldn't have promised at that point. I mean, there was no way that President Bush or Secretary Baker could have, you know, committed their successors to a self-abnegating act on the question of NATO enlargement. But your book's a great corrective to all that, a great corrective to Putin's propaganda. I hope when it's published next week by Columbia University Press that it gets the readership that it deserves, and thank you for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much, Eric, for having me. This was great to discuss all of these issues with you as a host and as a contemporary witnesses and diplomat who used to be involved in all of that. And you, I think you got it right. You guys got it right in the 1990s when you worked on all of these issues, and there's still a need for more research in the future on NATO enlargement, on the various aspects of European security and transatlantic relations and the U.S. role in Europe and the U.S. as a European power. And so there will be more research in the future, I think. Thank you so much.
Well, I think it'll start with your book as a point of departure.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.